The following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
The Nicole Sandler Show. Questioning authority daily. And that could be the very reason why YouTube is upset. Hey, YouTube. The music bed you hear beneath my voice is from a broadcast sound library that I paid for and have the receipts. So I've got your copyright violation right here. And now, here's Nicole.
All right. Oh, happy Friday, everyone. And happy Valentine's Day. Yes, it's February 14th. That's the day that, you know, people celebrate love. Granted, you know, through a commercial enterprise, and Hallmark, I'm sure, has a big stake in Valentine's Day. But where I live in South Florida, today is not the first thing we think of on February 14th is not Valentine's Day. It's what happened 2 years ago today. I live in the town of Coral Springs. Coral Springs is right next door, is the sister city to Parkland, Florida. We share a fire department and a police department. In fact, if you look at the any emergency vehicles in our area, it says Coral Springs, Parkland, fire, police, whatever. 2 years ago, right now, when my show began 2 years ago at this time, somebody in the chat room alerted me to the fact that, actually, no, I take that back. A few minutes before I went on the air, and I remember this. Well, I don't remember it. I went back and listened to the beginning of the show from 2 years ago today, thinking that I might play it, but no, I'm not going to do that. But just remembering how it unfolded, how I was getting the news during the program that there was an active shooting going on at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School. It's one of four high schools that serve our area. It's the one that's in Parkland. Parkland is a smaller town than Coral Springs. We have Coral Glades, Coral Springs, and Terra Vella High Schools, and then Marjorie Stoneman Douglas. You know, it was a rough day 2 years ago. As I'm doing the show, I just can't remember who the guest was that day, but it was, you know, business as usual. It was Valentine's Day and we did a show. But all throughout, I'm keeping an eye on the news where there's just wall-to-wall coverage on the local news stations because there's an active shooter at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School. And when I got off the air and went inside and you know, sat glued to the television, the severity of what had happened it became apparent. And to this day, 2 years later today, if you drive around our town, you see signs everywhere. You see MSD Strong for Marjorie Stoneman Douglas everywhere, signs in store windows. It's sort of a shared experience we have here. Last year, the city participated in this arts program. It was Arts and Healing. I've been remiss. I didn't pull the information on it. But if you noticed, if you're watching on YouTube or you went to the website at NicoleSandler.com and found today's show on today's blog entry, the graphic that I had up at the beginning that I have on the page, or will have on the page when it's posted, I've got it up on the YouTube screen now, shows a big, what looks like a sign that reads Peace and Love. Well, this is a sort of what they're calling a super billboard. It's a sculpture that's part of the Power of Art Project, made possible by a grant from Bloomberg Philanthropies. And you know what? I'm kind of busy today. I'm doing the broadcast tonight, so I'm stretched really thin. Plus, you know, it's Valentine's Day. We want to go out to dinner tonight, so I've been going nonstop all day. I believe it is that Bloomberg because he is the one issue he's really I think good on is gun control. Anyway, this structure, it's 130 feet long, 30 feet high, was designed by award-winning multidisciplinary artists Rosario Marquette and Roberto Bejar of R&R Studios. And it is an installment that is being dedicated right now as we speak here in Coral Springs on the corner of Sample Road and Sportsplex Drive, right down the street from the Coral Glades High School. There's another installation that's being dedicated, I think, today, closer to Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School. It says here, the Peace and Love installation will open to visitors on February 14th, the second anniversary of the Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School tragedy. The structure is expected to draw thousands of visitors until it's removed in May 2020. Coral Springs, in partnership with Parkland, received a $1 million, I guess, grant from Bloomberg Philanthropies in 2018 through its Public Art Challenge for the Inspiring Community Healing After Gun Violence, The Power of Art. The project is aimed at bringing the community together through art and reflection as a way to heal following the school shooting. Last year, there was an amazing installment erected on Sample Road here in Coral Springs that they called Temple of Time, and it was kind of built out of balsa wood. It was a light wood structure that was up for a couple of months. I think it was dedicated, as this is dedicated today, last year on February 14th, and it stood for a couple of months until it was burned down as part of the installation in May of last year. So this is all part of the healing process. And on the temple, people wrote messages all over the wood. There are videos of it, should you care to look for one. Google Temple of Time, Coral Springs, Florida, and you'll see there's lots of stuff on it. Watching that thing go up in flames in May was interesting. I'll put it that way. So anyway, that's what's happening here today. So I didn't start the program, as I do after there's a mass shooting, with a song by Cheryl Wheeler that I do play whenever these things happen. But what I did was I went back and I pulled the audio from the beginning of the show 2 years ago tomorrow, because last year, I believe Valentine's Day fell on a Thursday. So I did have a show the next day. And there is a funny coming up in here, but what I want to share with you is the beginning of the show I did the day after the shooting.
And today.
Yesterday.
Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School.
Let me. So this was the end of a clip. Actually, I'm not playing the whole thing because it's too long. But I think it was Anderson Cooper on CNN read a list of the 25 major school massacres that have occurred in this country since 1999. I think it was 1996, actually, the Columbine school shooting, which was the first, the one in Parkland 2 years ago, is actually the deadliest high school shooting in American history. I can't even think of the word. Horrible thing to note. So anyway, this is the end of Anderson Cooper wrapping up that long list of 25 school shootings with Marjory Stoneman Douglas.
And today,
yesterday,
Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School in Broward County, Florida, in the town of Parkland, where many students and teachers and administrators have died today. We do not yet know how many.
Well, we do know now.
Actually, it sounds like Shepard Smith.
The total is 17, but there are 5 still in critical condition in the hospital. I know this because this is local news where I live. Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School is about 10 minutes from my house. I live in the town of Coral Springs, Florida. The high school is in Parkland. And in fact, if you watched any of the news coverage and you saw the EMT vehicles, they all said Coral Springs, Parkland, because it's sort of our sister city. They're too small cities, they're towns really, that abut one another, and they share a lot of resources, including 4 high schools. Douglas is one of the 4. My daughter went to Coral Glades High School, which is a little bit closer to my house. It's a very populated area where it's a suburb of Fort Lauderdale. We're just northwest of Fort Lauderdale, and right on the tip of the Everglades, basically. Now, you know, all I could think was, Douglas, that's hitting very close to home. And it wasn't until early this morning when I awoke to find Allison just sitting in the living room, my daughter. She graduated from high school last June.
You hear this. This is,
again, as I said,
scary
from Coral
shit.
Glades High School. But for her last, for the last quarter of the school year, she didn't go to her high school. Instead, she went to my kid is a great kid. She really is. She was a lousy student. She hated school and just did not. School was not her thing. And she was slacking off at the end of the year. She only needed like 3 credits to graduate. But the only way to just do 3 credits was to withdraw from school and go into what they call the off-campus learning center. Well, little did we know at the time, the off-campus learning center is really where they put the kids who've been thrown out of school for whatever reason. So yesterday afternoon, I'm watching one of the local news reports, and I see this kid talking about going to an alternative school with the shooter. Here's a little bit of the conversation.
He's been a troubled kid, and he always had like a certain amount of, you know, issues going on. He shot guns because he felt that it gave him, I guess, what's the word I'm looking for? An exhilarating feeling. I don't know.
How did you know about his guns?
He showed me personally through his phone and stuff like that. I stayed clear of him most of the time during my time in an alternate school. I didn't want to be with him at all because I felt as though, like, I didn't want to cause any conflict with him because that's the impression he gave off.
You were in alternative school with him?
Yes. I actually got kicked out my junior year and then went into an alternative school, OCLC.
OCLC.
And that's where I met him again.
My heart skips a beat when I hear this.
My junior year, meeting him there.
So the 4 schools in our area, when they got kicked out, they had the option of going to the off-campus learning center, the OCLC, at one of these 4 high schools, a different one called Terra Vella, which is one of the other area schools, which is where Allison went. And she, I guess, last night saw a picture of the shooter. I don't say his name because fame is one of the things these monsters seek. And she said, Mom, I knew him. He was in my OCLC class.
Oh, God.
It's where they would go and work at their own pace. They'd each have a computer that they would work on and just finish their classes. So she went to do that. But there were some bad kids. She said he was really weird. He had really weird eyes is what she said. And he attempted to talk to her a few times. She didn't really engage with him. She just said, you know, she's a good kid. She tried to be nice to everybody. But she told me she told him that, you know, she just wanted to finish her work and finish up and get out of there. I can't even begin to tell you the feeling in my stomach when I realized that she was in close proximity with this kid for, you know, a few months. Because she went, it was the whole fourth quarter of her senior year of high school that she went to this off-campus learning center. It just brings it that much closer to home. Now, I've not been out in the area of Douglas High School. I know it's still crazy over there, and so I'll avoid the area while the police finish up doing what they're doing. And, of course, the media is out in full force. It's really horrific. It's horrific no matter where in the country it happens, just the fact that it keeps happening. And here we are with it. Now in my own backyard, it's just stunning. I don't know what the answer is. Cheryl Wheeler sings, I'd take away the guns. Chris Rock, I know this is not a time for comedy, but maybe we could use a little comedy right now.
Oh, yeah.
And actually, something that started as a comedy bit has picked up a lot of steam.
You don't need no gun control. You know what you need? We need some bullet control. We need to control the bullets. That's right. I think all bullets should cost $5,000. $5,000 for a bullet. You know why? Because if a bullet costs $5,000, there'll be no more innocent bystanders.
Yep.
Touche.
The end. Every time somebody gets shot, you be like, damn, he must have did something. Should they put $50,000 worth of bullets in his ass?
Yep.
And people will think before they kill somebody if a bullet costs $5,000. Man, I would blow your fucking head off if I could afford it.
Yeah. Right?
I'm gonna give me another job. I'm gonna start saving some money, and you a dead man. You better hope I can't get no bullets on layaway.
You know, somehow the laws in Florida are so crazy. This kid bought the gun, the AR-15, that he used to massacre 17 people with legally. In Florida, I just learned, you can't buy a handgun until you're 21. You know, a simple Glock or a revolver or something that fires, you know, one bullet at a time until you're 21. But he was able to buy this thing at the age of 18. Now this kid is 19, and he cut short the lives of 17 other people. So there's an excerpt from this program. 2 years ago, tomorrow, it was on the 15th, the day after the shooting, when we had learned, by that time, we had learned the enormity of what had happened. And things don't get better. They're not better. You drive down the Sawgrass Expressway, and which the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School sits right on the side of this highway. So you can see it from the highway at the Coral Ridge Drive exit. And they're building a new building now to replace the freshman building, which I believe they've already torn down where this happened. So, you know, and there are so many communities around the country that have experienced this. When it happens, it doesn't matter where it happens. It gets all of us. When it happens in your community, it's exponentially worse. It's just horrific. And again, listening to that and hearing the story about the kid, the shooter, was in this classroom with my daughter for a few months. She knew him. She said he was weird. And that freaks me the fuck out. So pardon me if I'm a little off today. It still weighs very heavily on my mind. It's a rough day everywhere, but especially here in our little area of South Florida. There's a lot going on, a lot of news to get to. We will. And Tom Hartman is our special guest today. He's got a new book out. Doesn't he always have a new book out? And this one is, it's very timely. It's The Hidden History of the War on Voting, Who Stole Your Vote and How to Get It Back. Obviously a very important issue for right now. But let's get to the news, because there's so much of it to share. And we'll do it live.
I read the news today, oh boy.
Ah, okay, we're doing it live. Damn it. All right, so despite Donald Trump's calls for his prosecution, we learned this afternoon that former FBI acting director Andrew McCabe, he's the guy who authorized the FBI's investigation into Donald Trump, he will not be investigated or prosecuted. They've dropped all the charges against him. He learned today. Let's see. McCabe will not face criminal charges. The Washington Post is reporting that the Justice Department revealed the decision to McCabe's team today. I'm trying to fix the YouTube shot and read my news copy at the same time. Give me 1 second here so I can make this actually look a little better. All right. So anyway, it was unclear if they have plans to make it public. Obviously, it's public now. The move will obviously infuriate Donald Trump, who has raged publicly and privately in recent months that McCabe and others he considers political enemies should be charged with crimes. This just out. So we heard about the McCabe thing earlier today. Now, within the last hour, we learned that the Army will not be investigating Alexander Vindman, who, of course, was just shown his way out of the White House, thanks to Donald Trump. This, according to Army Secretary Ryan McCarthy, again, despite Trump's request. Oh, and one more not related to this. Michael Avenatti, remember him? I always thought there was something a little off about him. Found guilty on 3 counts in the Nike extortion trial. Yeeks. All right, now on to the other news. Oops, he did it again.
And you knew he would. After being impeached for doing something similar, Donald Trump again publicly made a blatant request for a quid pro quo. He asked for a personal political favor in return for official government action. Just last week, the White House put a freeze on New York's Global Entry Program. That's their trusted traveler program, which will cause the many, many thousands of New Yorkers who use this program to lose the ability to speed through airport security or border crossings with Canada, a move Trump made in retaliation for New York Governor Andrew Cuomo's decision to block ICE from access to their DMV database. Well, yesterday afternoon, Trump tweeted, quote, "I'm seeing Governor Cuomo today at the White House. He must understand that national security far exceeds politics. New York must stop all of its unnecessary lawsuits and harassment, start cleaning itself up and lowering taxes, build relationships, but don't bring Fredo." I guess that's a nod or a diss on Chris Cuomo, the governor's brother, who is on CNN. Anyway, Walter Schaub, remember that name? He was the director of the Office of Government Ethics under Obama and at the beginning of the Trump administration until I think he finally quit because he couldn't deal with what was going on there. He tweeted, quote, "Barr's PR nonsense is not the story." We'll get to that in a minute. "The story is your president just engaged in Ukraine-level quid pro quo extortion, but this time against one of the United States. In plain sight on Twitter," in all caps. And then New York's Attorney General Letitia James chimed in on Twitter saying, "When you stop violating the rights and liberties of all New Yorkers, we will stand down. Until then, we have a duty and responsibility to defend the Constitution and the rule of law. By the way, I filed the lawsuits, not the governor." Boom. Now about that other big story. After days of mounting criticism about William Barr fulfilling his role as Trump's Roy Cohn in the wake of the DOJ's decision to walk back the initial sentencing recommendation for Roger Stone, the attorney general sat for an interview with ABC's Pierre Thomas.
"To have public statements and tweets made about the department, our people in the department, our men and women here, about cases pending in the department, and about judges before whom we have cases, make it impossible for me to do my job and to assure the courts and the prosecutors in the department that we're doing our work with integrity."
Okay, now remember, this is William Barr speaking. So, you know, I think I tweeted out yesterday, "I don't believe anything this creature says." And it got a lot of retweets and likes. And critics have suggested that Barr's comments to ABC News appearing to stand up to Trump were a coordinated attempt between him and the White House aimed at diffusing the outrage sparked by the Justice Department's decision to walk back the sentencing recommendation for Roger Stone. Yeah, gets curiouser and curiouser. All right, I told you about Andrew McCabe. Now, somehow, Barr doesn't seem to be in any danger of losing his job after criticizing the president. And you know, Donald Trump doesn't stand for anybody criticizing him. So it just adds fuel to the fire in my belief that, yeah, this was all planned. Well, anyway, you know, a few former White House staffers are reportedly returning. We heard Reince Priebus and Sean Spicer are headed back. And the first one returning is Hope Hicks. Remember Hope Hicks? Yeah, Donald's little girlfriend, young girl, didn't have any experience except working for Trump, but he apparently loves her. She will reportedly return as an advisor working closely with Jared Kushner. Though what I'm reading, what I'm hearing, and I have no idea if there's any truth to this or not, is that she's being brought back in because of Trump's deteriorating mental acuity. He's losing it. Okay, in other news, quickly, because we got to get to Tom Hartman in a few minutes. I still don't know which number I'm calling him on. He hasn't checked in yet. We'll figure it out. Anyway, a rare show of bipartisan action happened in the Senate yesterday when, by a vote of 55-45, the chamber voted to rebuke the president and limit his ability to launch military action in Iran. 8 Republicans joined all the Democrats to pass the resolution that would require Trump to secure congressional approval for military actions against Iran and for U.S. troops to be pulled from military engagement within 30 days if approval isn't granted. My question is, why did they limit it to Iran? Why didn't they just say he can't launch any military action without congressional approval? I don't know. Maybe the Republicans wouldn't go along with that. I don't know. Now, you know Jim Jordan. We pronounce it Jim as in gymnasium, or I should say we spell it. It's pronounced the same way. Jim Jordan can't shake the allegations that while he was assistant wrestling coach at Ohio State University in the early 90s, he turned a blind eye to direct reports alleging sexual abuse by then team doctor Richard Strauss. Well, on Tuesday, a former captain of the team and the brother of one of the alleged victims, a guy named Adam DeSabato, testified at a hearing on an Ohio State bill that would allow victims of Strauss to sue the university for damages. And basically he said, Jim Jordan is a fucking liar.
Jim Jordan called me crying, groveling on the 4th of July, begging me to go against my brother, begging me. Crying for a half hour. That's the kind of cover-ups that's going on there. Jim Jordan called me several times after that. That week, I had to have my lawyer call him, tell him to stop calling me. I had a teammate, George Pardos, I called and told him, call Jim Jordan and tell him to quit calling me or I'm going to beat his ass. He's throwing us under the bus, all of us. He's a coward. He's not a leader.
Okay.
He's a coward.
Yeah,
I'm a leader. I was captain of these guys. That's why I'm here. I would never abandon my team. He abandoned us. Our head coach abandoned us. He's flipped his story. He called other people to flip their story. He called Mark Coleman to flip his story. He called his parents, 90 years old. That's the kind of person Jim Jordan is.
Wow. So, you know, hearing it like that is kind of... It makes me say, okay, Democrats, do something about this guy. Do something about this guy. Do something about all of them. All right, and finally, one more story. Last month was the hottest January ever recorded on Earth. This according to NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. The average temperature across land and ocean surfaces was 2.05 degrees Fahrenheit above the 20th century average of 53.6 degrees. It was also the 421st straight month with temperatures higher than the average. Russia, Scandinavia, and Eastern Canada were hit hardest with temperatures 9 degrees above average or more. They say Alaska and parts of Western Canada were exceptions to the trend with their temperatures cooler than normal, but I remember hearing that... Alaska has been really warm, so who knows? Anyway, there's a bit of the news for you. All right, coming up, again, we have Tom Hartman. Now, I'm supposed to call him. We arranged to do it, you know, on Skype. I use Skype for my main phone here. But I wanted to connect with him because the last couple of times Tom Hartman's been on the program, we've done it by phone and it's been on his cell and it's been not necessarily the best connection. But he has not answered my question. There were two Tom Hartman accounts on Skype that look like they could be him and he hasn't answered either one of them. So I'm thinking I'm just going to call his phone and hope it works. Because, you know, again, I work without a producer, so I don't have anyone making these phone calls for me, you know, on the fly behind the scenes. So let me try to call Tom Hartman and see what happens. We'll figure it out. I'm actually back on the other computer, so we shouldn't have the audio problems that I had yesterday. We shall see. Hold on. All right, so we're calling Tom Hartman.
Hello.
Hey, Tom Hartman, it's Nicole Sandler calling.
Hey, Nicole, how are you?
Well, how are you?
Great. Are we on the air?
We are on the air. I was going to Skype you, but I couldn't figure out the right Skype thing. So I'm glad you answered because, you know, it's live radio and I work without a producer. So here we are.
There you go.
So we just wing it. We move ahead. So, Tom, before, you know, I do my show live now at 3 o'clock. It airs on the Progressive Voices Network at 5 Eastern. But I come on following your show on Progressive Voices for the live show. So as I'm setting up my board and all my stuff, I have you playing in the background. And it's so funny because today I'm hearing all these ads for your new books. I heard an ad today for your new book, The Tom Hartman Reader, and it sounded great, but I'm thinking that's not the book we're talking about today.
That's an older book.
Oh, it's
those must be old ads that are being recycled somehow.
Yeah.
That was years ago.
Oh, wow. Because there are a bunch of ads that say, my new book is out. And so, yeah, just you may want to update.
I had no idea.
It's on Progressive Voices. So I guess they're using that as filler.
Yeah.
So anyway, the new book that we're here to discuss today is The Hidden History of the War on Voting, Who Stole Your Vote, and How to Get It Back. This is the third in the series, the Hidden History series. How many are there total in the series?
Well, we'll see. I've written four. I'm halfway done with the fifth right now. The next one will be The Hidden History of Monopoly, how big business destroyed the American dream. And the one that I'm working on right now is The Hidden History of Oligarchy, basically the destruction of democracy.
Well, great timing on that one. And we'll actually get to a little of that today. So, I mean, it's great timing on the book. And obviously, you planned it that way. The book just came out at the beginning of the week and just in time for the first in the nation primary. We've got two down, 55 to go before we finish up the primary season. And after the first two, it's really apparent how broken our system is, right? We had the Iowa debacle in which Bernie Sanders garnered 6,000 more votes in the popular vote, but lost what they call SDEs, the delegate estimates, by 1/10 of 1 percentage point. And he's awarded one fewer delegate than Pete Buttigieg, who topped him by 0.1%. And then in New Hampshire, Bernie wins by a smaller margin this time, but close to 2 points. But he receives exactly the same number of delegates as Pete Buttigieg. This system really sucks. So, and that's not even the worst of it. So obviously we have a problem, right, Tom Hartman?
Yeah. So what happened in Iowa was a technology disaster. They were just too slick by half. They thought that they could, you know, have everybody send the results in on this fancy new app, and wouldn't that be wonderful? And it turns out that the app didn't work. And there's even conspiracy theories popping up around that because the Buttigieg campaign apparently paid about $40,000 to the app developer.
Uh-huh.
But in New Hampshire, I mean, they just did it the way they've always done it. So that's an issue that we need to take up with the Democratic Party if we think that delegates should be allocated exactly by the vote count. But I'm not, with a 1 or 0.5% spread or even a 2 or 3% spread between the two leading candidates, and only, as I recall, are there 12 delegates out of New Hampshire? Not sure that that's a large enough margin that you would slice it differently than that. But, you know, because somehow you've got to reduce, hundreds of thousands of votes down to 12 delegates.
Right.
So it might be a math problem more than anything else.
And again, the whole delegate thing is so cumbersome, right? And that's not even the worst of it, because the delegates pledged during the primaries determine the nominee. Well, sort of, kind of. They take those to the convention and then they vote on the nominee, and then they make way, the delegates, whoever they come out of the convention with, they make way for the Electoral College in the general election. When, I don't know, color me simple, but a popular vote just seems like it would make more sense. One person, one vote, you count the votes, the person with the most vote wins. And we're jumping through all these hoops to do these mathematic calisthenics, and none of it makes any sense.
Right. Back in the day, and I don't recall exactly what year it was, but it was in my lifetime. It was, I believe, somewhere in the late 50s, early 60s. The Democratic Party went from smoke-filled rooms where the delegates were basically elected officials. They were the people that today we call superdelegates, by and large.
Right.
And delegates who had been picked by local officials and politicians in the individual states, where they all got together in the old smoke-filled rooms and hammered out the compromises, you know, that got us, for example, Harry Truman. The party realized that, A, you know, the grassroots were unhappy with that, and B, it didn't look good on television, which I think is one of the main things. Mm. And they wanted to open it up and make it seem like a democratic process, but they didn't want to throw out the delegates because, you know, maybe we have to go back to that. Maybe this won't work. And so it became, you know, a popular vote to elect the delegates, or elect, not even the delegates themselves, elect a certain number of delegates. I agree with you, Nicole. I think that if the Democratic Party was simply to go with simple vote counting, that we'd be way ahead of the curve.
Right.
And we may get there one of these days, maybe even one of these days soon, because there's a lot of people really seriously pissed off at the DNC right now.
As they should be. I mean, just the first two contests already have, you know, me pulling my hair out. That's not difficult to make happen. But seriously, this, none of it makes sense. And if we're trying to, you know, elect a candidate, a nominee, it should go to the person who gets the most votes. So it's, you know, the simple way I look at it.
Yes.
So in the book, Tom Hartmann, the book, the Hidden History of the War on Voting, it's split into three parts. In the first part, you present the history of the vote in the United States, why the Electoral College instead of a direct democracy. So why was it set up this way? Why did the founders do this?
It was an anti-Donald Trump effort.
Of course it was.
Seriously. Yeah. When they were putting together the executive branch, Article 2 of the Constitution, this was in July of 1787 in Philadelphia. One of the big concerns was that at that point in time, I mean, the United States, well, I guess we were arguably the United States, we were operating under the Articles of Confederation, but we were at that point in time, if not the largest, one of the largest developed countries, Western countries in the world. You know, you can fit large chunks of Europe inside North Carolina and certainly in Georgia. And so the question was, with this huge geographic distance, how does a voter in Georgia or a voter in Maine or New Hampshire, actually, Maine wasn't a state yet, I don't think, how does a voter in New Hampshire get to know somebody who's in Washington, D.C. running for president? You know, how does that happen? And there really was no way to do it. I mean, they had about as far as Congress had gone was to create the fourth class postal rate so that newspapers could mail their newspapers out basically super, super cheap, almost free, which we still have, by the way, which is, you know, a leftover from the founders wanting to promote newspapers and news. So if you read the debates they had, I think it was George Mason brought up this question of, you know, well, what if, you know, say you got two leading candidates and the elect and people are being asked to choose between them. But when you get to Washington, D.C. and you actually sit down and have a dinner with these guys and you discover that one of them's a drunk, you know, a drunkard,
right,
was the word he used.
Right.
You know, what do we do? You know, how do you keep that guy from being president who's manifestly unqualified to be president?
Right.
And so the idea that they came up with was based on something the Iroquois Confederacy did, which was, you know, you had five different nations, and once a year they had a big conference of all the different nations, and each nation would, each region, each local tribe would essentially elect a wise elder who would travel to the big annual hoop-de-doop and express the desires and concerns of their community and then bring back to their community, you know, what was discussed in the powwow or in the confab or whatever they called it.
Right.
And, you know, the founders were very familiar with this. And it was also, there was a similar model from the pre-Roman invasion tribal societies who lived in England. And they called it the Vicar Gemeinschaft, where once a year everybody came from all over England, these tribal people. And Jefferson was a big fan of this. This was outlined in the Whig Histories by Paul de Ripon de Terrasse. And so the idea was that the electors, you know, it'd be a door that swings both ways. On the one hand, local communities would select an elector, and the Constitution explicitly says they may not be elected officials. It can't be somebody who is a politician. It can't be somebody who has an agenda. They have to be representing the community.
Okay.
So the community elects wise elders. They send the wise elders to Washington, D.C. saying, you know, we really think we'd rather have Jefferson than Adams, but check it out. And then the electors get to Washington, D.C., and they meet the candidates, and they generally vote the way that they were sent to vote, but they have the power to become what we call faithless electors, or unfaithful electors. They have the power to vote for anybody.
Right.
And so it was designed to be a safety valve, a mechanism that would prevent us from ending up with a manifestly unfit president.
Right.
And, you know, you could argue that for the first 30 or 40 or 50 years, it actually worked fairly well.
Hmm.
But after that, it became an anachronism. I mean, then you had, by the 1860s, you had the railroads connecting both sides of the country. The country was even much larger. You had national newspapers. News was traveling fast. Within 20 years after that, you had telegraphs. And now it's a complete anachronism. There's absolutely no need for, no rationalization for the Electoral College other than the fact that it works to the advantage of the Republican Party.
Right. And the fact is that the electors could have said, you know what, Donald Trump is unqualified to be president. He shouldn't be. They could have dismissed him. They could have voted for a different nominee. They could have voted for a different...
They could have, but I'm guessing that members of the Electoral College these days have no idea about that conversation that was held in Philadelphia.
Right.
That they don't know that that's actually their mandate. That they just think that, you know, it's their job to go vote, you know, for the person that they were told to vote for.
Right. So that's how we got into this mess. And, you know, obviously... There's a whole book that you have written about this. We're leaving out an important part, which is recounted in the section you call Power to the South, the Three-Fifths Compromise, because slavery also had something to do with this. So all of these issues contributed to this system that we have now that does not work in 2020. So let's jump ahead, because in part two of the book, you describe it as how big money interests have used the system to perpetuate inequality that benefits the super rich and corporations while ignoring the will of most Americans. Republicans, through gerrymandering and other voter suppression tactics, have hijacked our political system to favor billionaires and corporations. And that's, we're seeing it. We're seeing it in everything today. There's a clip that I play fairly often. I think I first heard it through your show, a long, long time ago, that was recorded back in 1980. A guy named Paul Weyrich, who is one of the founders of the Heritage Foundation, is it? Or
yes.
Okay.
And, Heritage.
Right. And this was when they realized that it's better for the Republicans if people don't vote. Here's what Paul Weyrich said.
Not
here it goes.
Christians have what I call the goo-goo syndrome. Good government. They want everybody to vote. I don't want everybody to vote. Elections are not won by a majority of people. They never have been from the beginning of our country, and they are not now. As a matter of fact, our leverage in the elections, quite candidly, goes up as the voting populace goes down.
So that happened in 1980, the year Ronald Reagan won. This, now, but we went through a time when there were efforts to make the vote, I think, fairer. We had in 1965 the Voting Rights Act, which was gutted 7 years ago. Is this 1980? Is this when the current trajectory began? When the Republicans realized that they're better off if they could keep people from actually voting?
In large part, Richard Nixon was probably the last Republican who ran for office on a platform, on, you know, thinking that the way to win the election is to talk about issues that people care about. I mean, you know, that patina has been on all Republican candidacies. Mm-hmm. But what happened, Nicole, was kind of a weird combination of two different things. The first was in 1976. Two things happened. One, Jerry Ford was beat by Jimmy Carter, which totally shocked the Republican Party and demoralized. I mean, there were literally, this is, you know, just 2 years after the Nixon scandals, there were books being written about how the Republican Party was going to go the way of the Whigs and, you know, what's going to replace it and it's doomed and all this kind of stuff. And so they were just out in the wilderness and freaked out. And that same year, the U.S. Supreme Court, in a 5-4 decision, Buckley versus Vallejo, ruled that if a billionaire wants to own a politician or even a dozen politicians, give them so much money that he's essentially their patron, that they do what he wants all the time, that's no longer called corruption or bribery. That is now called free speech, because money is the same thing as speech, and speech is protected by the First Amendment. And then 2 years later in 78, in a decision called First National Bank versus Bilotti, they extended that logic to corporations, to corporate donors and owners of politicians.
Now, when you say they, Tom, who are they? Because I know you've told
this
story.
This is the conservative majority on the court.
Okay, and they were the Supreme Court never actually ruled on this, though, back then. It was,
yes, they did.
Oh, they did. I thought there were notations in the margins of a different ruling.
No, that's corporate personhood. This is money as speech. This was an actual ruling in 1976, Buckley versus Blaio, 1978, First National Bank versus Boston versus Bilotti.
Okay.
And these two decisions created an environment where in 1979, the Republican Party, now the Democratic Party in 79 was fat and happy. I mean, they had the unions. We were about a third of Americans had union jobs. The unions were flush with cash, so much cash, in fact, that some of them were getting corrupted by it. The famous Hoffa stuff. But in any case, the Democratic Party was just fine, thank you very much. But the Republican Party was in a crisis. And so when the Supreme Court said that politicians and political parties, by extension, can be owned by special interests, by individual billionaires and individual corporations, the Republican Party put out a for sale sign, said, cool, we'll take your money, whoever you are. And they started taking money from tobacco, and they started taking money from oil, and they started taking money from coal, and they started taking money. I mean, you just name it, right? And all these right-wing billionaires and their foundations and the Bradleys and the Scaifes and the Coors and everybody. And that brought us Ronald Reagan in 1980. Then Reagan started destroying the unions. And by the end of the 12 years of Reagan-Bush, union membership in the United States was almost half of what it had been when Reagan came into office, at which point the Democratic Party was now in a crisis. And that's when Bill Clinton said, okay, we're going to start taking corporate money too, only we're all only going to take it from white-collar corporations, pharmaceuticals, health insurance, big banks. Those are the people who are going to fund the Democratic Party now. Which is kind of far afield of the whole conversation. But that's when it began. That's when the Republican Party decided that if we're going to take money from these people that everybody hates, we can't run on that. And they came up with these BS things, voodoo economics. George Bush actually tried to call it BS. But they came up with these stories. But, what was really going on was that they had sold out. And so how do you win an election when people know that you're a sellout? You prevent the people who know that you're a sellout from voting.
Right.
And that's when they started caging aggressively, which is where they send postcards into poor neighborhoods. And they say, return this postcard if you still live at this address. And if people didn't return them, then the Republican Party would go in and challenge their voter status and have them removed from the voting rolls. For 20 years, the Republican Party operated under a restraining order that the Democrats got, preventing them from doing this, although they continued to do it in very aggressively.
And they still do it.
They weren't supposed to.
Right. And they were still doing it.
Now they do it legally.
Yeah. We'll get there. So this has been a process that kicked into full gear, I guess, around 1980 after Richard Nixon in the time of Ronald Reagan. And it's just been more of that since. Are the Democrats just not strategic? Are they not smart to play the long game? Republicans have been playing the long game for decades now, and the Democrats seem to be taken by surprise all the time.
Yeah. I don't know. that's one of the more discouraging questions.
Yeah, I know. I'm sorry.
The Democratic Party has gone through, it's really been whipsawed. I mean, Clinton and Al Fromm and the DLC, frankly, in my opinion, destroyed the Democratic Party. When they sold it out. Now, to their credit, you could say they didn't know that they had an alternative. I mean, they literally didn't have enough money in 1992 to launch a national campaign against the Republicans if they didn't take money from the banks and the billionaires. And now, in the post-internet era, it is possible to compete on a more level playing field, but it wasn't then in 92. And so Clinton did what he had to do to get himself elected and completely changed the Democratic Party. And now we've got the Democratic Party, or at least probably half, slightly less than half of the Democratic Party, trying to return to those FDR LBJ Great Society roots, you know, the genuine progressive roots of the Democratic Party, and trying to reject, you know, the Clinton corporatism.
Well, those of us who are for Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren, and there is a big divide there. But adding on to that, we go back 10 years, just 10 years ago, less than a month ago, the Supreme Court gave us their ruling on Citizens United. And here we are 10 years later with a multi-billionaire trying to buy the Democratic nomination. That's problematic on so many levels. But to cut to the chase, I believe if Michael Bloomberg is the nominee, if he buys this nomination, because that's going to be how he wins it if he does, I think it'll be the end of the Democratic Party. Now, you think I'm overstating it?
I don't know. I honestly don't know, and it troubles me. You know, for example, I mean, Bernie is the clear front runner right now. The Morning Consult poll yesterday had him at 29%, and, you know, next up was Joe Biden at 19%. That's a 10-point lead. That's huge. Yep. Buttigieg at 18%, and everybody else below 11%, including Joe Biden. So if Bernie ends up the clear front runner, and the party decides to give the, and we have a brokered convention, and then the 700 and some odd superdelegates come in, and they just hand it to Bloomberg. It's going to be dispiriting, to say the very least.
I think you're understating that. I think if they go into the convention and Bernie Sanders has a plurality, meaning more votes than anyone else, though not 51%, they have the way the DNC rules are. On the second ballot, the delegates are free to do what they want, and the super delegates are in the mix, and all bets are off. But I've spoken to a lot of people about this who believe that, and I heard David Plouffe, of all people, say this on television the other day, that if the Democratic Party, if Bernie Sanders goes into the convention with a plurality, and he is not allowed to win the nomination, that things are going to get ugly real fast.
Yeah, and I agree with that. And so if Bloomberg is going to be a viable candidate, the work he has to do is to one of two things. Either one, to convince enough Americans that he's the guy, that he actually, he's the one with the plurality or the majority. And I think that that's possible if you're going to spend $1 billion. I mean, advertising works, right? It's why commercial radio exists. I wouldn't rule out the possibility that Bloomberg actually goes into the convention with a majority of the delegates.
Really?
But if he doesn't, if the scenario that you just described happens, then the thing that Bloomberg needs to do on the next morning or even that afternoon would be to declare that either Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren is his running mate.
Yeah.
You know, bring a progressive in. That's the only way I can think of to heal a party from that kind of a rift.
Do you see?
And if he does like Hillary Clinton did and brings in a bozo Tim Kaine. I mean, Tim Kaine's not a terrible guy. I shouldn't call him a bozo.
But he's not what Mr. Whitebread, time called for. Exactly. You know? Exactly. Do you think Bernie Sanders would even consider running with Michael, being Michael Bloomberg's vice president? Because I don't see it. I think
Bernie has already said that if Michael Bloomberg is the party's nominee,
he will support him.
He will campaign for him.
Yep. Well, and Michael Bloomberg has said that he'll put his whole organization and his billions of dollars behind whoever the nominee is, even if
including
it is Bernie,
Bernie
or Elizabeth Warren or Bernie Sanders. I have a hard time believing that. I think we've been burned so many times, and this whole thing leaves such a bad taste in my mouth that I'm genuinely concerned about what's going to happen, because
I'm concerned, but I'm trying not to fan the flames.
Gotcha. I know. It's a tightrope we walk.
Let the process work out.
Well, you know. So Tom Hartmann, again, the book is The Hidden History of the War on Voting. I mentioned there are three parts to it. And the third part, you offer solutions. You say that would both extend the vote to all Americans and create a system to ensure that elections result in outcomes that more closely align with the preferences of the American people. I haven't gotten that far in the book yet, but to me, that's a national popular vote. Is that what you're advocating?
Among other things, yeah. The nationalpopularvote.com actually is the website for maybe .org, whatever it is, but I'm pretty sure it's .com. For the interstate compact, that's up to 170 electoral votes right now, to do away with the electoral college, essentially make it easy to vote, have the vote by mail be the default. If people want to go to a polling place, fine. When Oregon went to vote by mail, we still had polling places if people wanted to go, and nobody ever showed up, so they stopped having You know, it's so much more convenient. I get my ballot 3 weeks before the election, and, you know, the reason I figure out who we're going to vote for, and it just works. Automatic voter registration. The most important thing, though, I mean, the biggest thing that the Republicans are using right now to own elections is voter suppression by throwing people off the voting rolls.
Right.
And then when those people show up to vote, they're given a provisional ballot, which is never counted. And so they think that they voted, and they tell the exit pollsters for whom they voted. But in fact, their vote literally is never counted, at least in the red states.
Right.
And that's why
in the
2016 election, Hillary Clinton carried, according to the exit polls, Hillary Clinton carried Florida by 47% to 46%. But the actual vote was 49% to 47% in favor of Trump. In North Carolina, she carried North Carolina 48% to 46%. But the so-called real vote was 49% to 46% against her. In Pennsylvania, and that was a 5.9% swing. In Pennsylvania, so 5.9% of the people had been thrown off the voting rolls and didn't even realize that their vote wasn't counted. Pennsylvania, same deal. Hillary Clinton won by 50% to 46%. But when the, quote, eligible voters were counted, it was 48% to 47% in favor of Trump. Wisconsin, and it was a 5.6% redshift. In Wisconsin, it was a 5.1% redshift. Hillary Clinton carried Wisconsin 48% to 44%, but the official count was 48% to 47% in favor of Trump. There's no doubt in my mind, based on these exit poll results, which are the gold standard, by the way.
I mean,
that's how we took down the Yanukovych government in Ukraine in 2004 with the Orange Revolution. The exit poll showed that the democracy guy won and the Russia guy lost, and the Russian guy was about to install himself, you know.
And that
was about a 5-point swing.
But in the last
got 5 and 6-point swings in our own states.
Right. But in the last few elections, when the exit polls don't match the results we're getting, they adjust the exit polls, which makes no sense to me. Right.
Yeah.
So
yeah, it's a crime. It's the media does this so that and they don't even bother reporting the exit poll results anymore outside of the deep dive stuff. You know,
right.
Why did you vote for this person?
Mm-hmm.
So they're now using it for minutia, basically. But every other country in the world and the United Nations and the Carter Center all use exit polls to determine the outcome of elections. I used to live in Europe. I lived in Germany. Every ballot in Europe is counted on paper.
Yep.
It's hand cast and hand counted. It's like jury duty in Germany. You get a notice in the mail that you have to be one of the ballot counters, and your employer has to give you 3 days off work because it takes 3 days to count all the votes.
Oh, how interesting.
So they call the election the night of the election based on the exit polls.
Wow. And I know they do that in the UK as well. They each
And they do it in Canada. Yeah,
right.
We just saw it with the Boris Johnson election.
Yeah, yeah. So we have a lot of work to do. It's going to be a battle between the Republicans, who we know don't want you to be able to vote, and the Democrats, who know that the more people that vote, the better the Democrats will do in the election. So I know, Tom, we're getting close to the end of the hour. You have an event in Los Angeles tomorrow that I know is sold out, but our mutual friend Brad Friedman is going to be there with you. And when you said they don't count the provisional ballots, I heard Brad in my head screaming, "No, they do. Don't tell people they don't count provisional ballots." So,
they do in California, but they don't in most red states.
Wow. Yeah. So,
and that's where I'm talking about. That's where these elections are being decided by these swing states that are controlled by Republican secretaries of state. In 2004, I had John Edwards on my show just screaming about the fact that, you know, John Kerry had, quote, lost Ohio by 160,000 votes, and there were 186,000 provisional ballots that had not yet been opened.
Oh, my God. Yeah. And
still haven't to this day.
And again,
they literally don't even open them unless you've got a court order.
Wow. And right now the courts are being stacked with Republicans, thanks to Moscow Mitch and Donald Trump. So the decks are stacked against us. So the way I look at it is, and I hate to say this because this is not democratic, but and people have heard this over and over again, we need to turn out in such huge numbers in November that they can't steal it from us. There is no excuse for not showing up. You point out in the book how few people voted to nominate Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton and elect them ultimately. Most people did not vote. That's the problem. Everyone's got to vote. We need to make that happen. That's, I guess, our job.
Yep. Amen.
Tom Hartman. Find him, of course, on the Tom Hartman Show on the radio at Tom_Hartman on Twitter. And the book is The Hidden History of the War on Voting. Thank you so much, Tom. It's always a pleasure to talk with you, and I always appreciate your time on my show.
Thanks, Nicole. You're the best. I really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you so much. Have a great weekend. Bye-bye. And happy Valentine's Day. So, all right, I'm done. I'm running long again. But this weekend, go to a shelter. It's a great time to adopt a dog or a cat. Most shelters, the ones down here, the one I work at, have all the adoption fees waived for Valentine's Day. So, you know, go do something good. And a dog will warm your heart. All right. Thanks for listening, everyone. Have a great weekend. I'll see you back here Tuesday. Thanks. Bye. And vote.